Europe is complicated. Where have you and Kieran been for 3 weeks? Previously in Europe, 2017.
So, Hugh, we've had a wee break there. We apologize. We posted on Twitter and Facebook group to say where we were. But for anyone who's not on those groups, first question, why aren't you? You should join them. They're great. And second point, Hugh was deathly ill before going back to Ireland. And then he was back in Ireland away from his microphone. And then I went to Spain to see my family away from my microphone. So, yeah, it didn't really work out. We wanted to do some special episodes and stuff. But now we're going to do a bit of a catch-up, a year in review. And then next episode, we will do a special episode.
Yes, because again, I'm not free next week to record, so we would have had to take a break, but this time we're prepared because I'm not as ill as I was.
Woo!
Though my voice might drop out dramatically at some point during this episode. We'll see!
I have a really bad cold at the moment, or flu, but I think my allergy medication is stopping a lot of the symptoms.
Well, that's problematic.
Yes. Anyway, so this is an interesting one. Was the Catalonia election happened while we were away?
Yes.
And this was interesting for me because I was in Spain while it was happening.
You were.
I was in Andalusia. I couldn't be further from Catalonia if I tried. Morocco would have been a good attempt, but
You could be in one of the weird North African cities that are, you know, Spain,
owned by Spain
technically.
Ceuta or Melilla, I can't remember how those pronounced. I watched a lot of the results unfold on like bar televisions while eating like burgers.
Nice.
Because I was being cultural, I went to Spain to get a burger.
That's pretty cultural, man.
So here is the rundown of the results of the election. It's worth pointing out that there was like a really high turnout this year for the elections. The last election was in 2015, which had 74.9%. But the turnout this year was 79% in total.
I thought it was in the 80s. Was that the did they initially say, were people giving out estimated numbers that were higher?
Yeah, there was estimated numbers that were higher. The final turnout figure is 79%.
Right. I think I remember hearing like 84 and thinking like that's kind of like phony dictator numbers where they're like, oh, I won the election by 90% and the turnout was over 80.
Yeah. The gentleman's dictatorial.
Yeah, right.
Sham election. Yeah. No, 79% turnout, the highest I think it's ever been for like local Catalonian elections since they started being a thing in like the new Spanish Kingdom of Spain in 1978. Yeah.
Yes.
Picked up a lot of Spanish facts. Anyway, so turnout was quite high, which makes sense. It was a pretty important election. And Ciudadanos, who are like a self-described center-left party, but a lot of people, particularly in Andalusia, view them as center-right. Because Andalusia is like the socialist stronghold of Spain.
Well, maybe they should be independent and have no money. But lots of forest fires.
A lot of forest fires, yes. And they also have to deal with Gibraltar, which they don't like.
Oh, that's mean.
Yeah.
They've got monkeys. They don't
like Gibraltar because of what the area of Spain that looks like immediately outside of Gibraltar looks like.
Yeah.
Everyone I meet in Spain is like, La Linea as a whole.
Yeah. Well, you know, shout out to La Linea.
Anyway. Yeah, so Ciudadanos, who are self-described as centre-left, but they're a member of the Liberal Democratic European Party, anyway, they got the most seats out of any one party, 36 out of the total 135 seats up for grabs, up 11 seats since the last election. For anyone who doesn't know, they are kind of like Spain's main centrist party. And they are strongly anti-Catalonian independence and are fine with the current level of autonomy. The reason I have to talk about this quite a bit is because I think they started in Catalonia. right. as a party.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, they, I think, in a lot of interviews, get pushed with the question, "Oh, what do you think of Catalonian independence?"
Yeah,
which I think is kind of frustrating to a lot of their like membership, because they're like, "We didn't really start intend for this party to be a Catalonian party."
No, yeah, yeah, yeah. We have other more important national things that we think we want to talk about, and you're talking.
Yeah,
yeah.
But the reason people in Catalonia find them as like a frustrating party is because they are fine with the current level of autonomy.
Yes.
Which most polls seem to indicate that the majority of people within Catalonia just want more autonomy. They don't want independence, but they all are also not happy with the current status quo.
Yeah, that's the kind of, that I think that would be the thing that you get the you get a safe Catalonian majority if there were like a vote where that were an option. If it was yes or no to that, it would be yes, you know. Anyway.
No substantial party seems to be offering that as a platform, though, which I think a lot of Catalonians and anyone watching this would probably find particularly frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, Ciudadanos got the most seats out of any one party, but that's not the big deal, because the pro-independence parties, who have historically worked in the past together, mm-hmm. Have an outright majority.
Yes.
Combined, they have 70 out of 135 seats. That is the new Junts per Catalunya mm-hmm. party, which is Puigdemont's new party after the official successor to the Democratic Convergence of Catalonia,
yeah.
which is a center-to-center-right, pro-independence, pro-European, Catalonian party.
Yeah, right.
It means Together for Catalonia, Junts per Catalunya. They have 34 seats. They're the largest of the three. Cool. The next largest is Esquerra Republicana de Catalunya, dash Catalunya C. I like these party names. Roll right off the tongue.
Verbose, that's what you like. You like things to be verbose.
I like things being verbose, yes. Verbose party titles. They are a left-wing social democracy pro-independence Catalonia party.
Yes.
They got 32 of the seats, up 6 seats.
Yes.
And then the small little kingmaker pro-independence party is Popular Unity Candidacy dash Constituent Call. They are far left, anti-capitalist.
Uh-huh.
They have 4 seats, but they lost 6. But that's enough to give them the 70 out of 135. If they're not working with them, I still think they have a majority. Yeah, 70 minus 4. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it'd be a slimmer majority.
Yes, yeah, which wouldn't be ideal.
Which wouldn't be great. Other notable results from this is that... yeah, they have been in a parliamentary group before called, it's abbreviated as JXC, mm-hmm. like not the letter C, the Spanish word C, meaning yes, which is an abbreviation of Junts per C, which is Together for Yes.
Yeah, because they're basically the pro-independence coalition is kind of what they are. Right. But yeah, I think that like so the result of this was effectively like technically the largest individual party is like anti-independence. However, the pro-independence like parties that like agree on that issue are bigger or are like a comfortable majority overall. Yeah. And the like Catalan version of Rajoy's party, the prime minister, the Catalan version of the Popular Party, got wiped out. Like, they had some seats, and they lost them all? Was that right? Yeah.
Yeah, not all of them. They had... the last election, 2015, got them 11 seats.
Yes.
Which is a big deal. They're like...
Yeah.
The two big parties aren't really successful within Catalonia.
Yes.
And that includes PP. So 11 seats is a big deal for them, but they got wiped out to 4. They are the biggest loser, both in raw numbers and percentage.
Yeah, which isn't surprising based on the, like, press around... press around the Catalan election was effectively 4 against independence. The response from Madrid was the wrong response.
Yeah, I mean, that's also the position of, I think, this podcast, which is like, it doesn't really matter what you think about Catalonian independence. Rajoy's response was way too heavy.
Yeah, I think like there's a lot of opinions I have In fact, I would say probably all my opinions that I would say shouldn't be enforced for police crackdown. But you know, that's just me. I'm not the Spanish prime minister. That's fine. I'm just saying.
You know, as an individual, I believe in traditional values and not enforcing a police station.
But that's just me, you know.
This is me.
Anyway, okay, let's move away from Catalonia because unless you wanted something else to say.
Yeah, I just have some small post-election things that happened. The other seats were kind of split evenly between like Podemos and the Socialists.
Yeah, right.
They're Catalonian branches. Nothing remarkable there. They're not going to be involved in like forming a government.
No.
So yeah, the Spanish police have left Catalonia again after returning to monitor the election, which sure made everyone feel super chill after what happened last time.
But they didn't get the Tweety Bird boat back, which was upsetting.
No, they didn't get the Tweety Bird boat. It's the weirdest symbol of oppression. Anyway.
Warner Brothers has arrived.
Oh, no. It's just the Looney Tunes theme plays on, like, air raid sirens.
Oh, no.
What Kafka's nightmare have we entered? Anyway, the other two points I want to say was after the results, Puigdemont kind of declared it a victory for wanting, Catalonian independence.
Yes.
And, you know, this plebiscite, he was referring to this election as a plebiscite being enforced by the Madrid government, which to a certain extent it's kind of true, but it's also a legit election. So come on. But it was like testing the waters on what does Catalonia want.
Yeah.
And he declared it like a failure on their part.
Yeah.
And from Brussels. And he said he's willing to meet Rajoy anywhere but Spain. Earlier today, unsurprisingly, Rajoy rejects a meeting.
I'm willing to meet you anywhere in Spain.
I really hope it's just like the two of them shouting to each other opposite this like dividing line in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, you know what? They could meet at the Catalan French border. That'd be ironic.
Or Andorra.
Yeah. Ooh, good.
Ooh.
I think that falls too well into Puigdemont's request.
Yeah, because Catalonian is their like national language. Anyway.
Moving to Austria, are the Austrians finally have a government?
You might be asking.
Yeah, you might be asking. Didn't Austria already have a government? The answer was no. Countries that have coalition governments in general tend to take a while to form them. So the this is the coalition everyone expected. It's the UPV, which is the Austrian People's Party, which is the center, kind of more center right party, but with Sebastian Kurz, the shockingly young ex foreign minister who is now going to be prime minister, and the Freedom Party, the let's call them extreme right, the FPÖ, who they've basically had their ministerial team approved. And the government has been formed. So it's Kurz and 8 members of the OPV, and then the FPÖ get seven members for the cabinet, including... So they've nominated a non-party member who's, like, officially independent, but is seen as, like, a...
sympathetic.
Sympathetic. And they're nominating him to be foreign minister, and they're getting largely, like, defense and security-style cabinet positions, which is kind of... It's kind of their... Like, as in, that's the kind of thing stuff they care about. So, you know, it's not shocking. Yeah, it's not shocking they're not getting like foreign trade and stuff.
I'd love if they're like, and we've given cultural minister and diversity improvement.
Transport minister. Though they might have these ministries. I don't know for sure, but they're getting the focus is more on. So they can fulfill their campaign promises in some way. Kurz is like personally promising that it'll be pro-EU, despite the FPÖ and their like getting foreign ministry and stuff. But like Kurz himself isn't anti-EU.
No.
But it's a pretty far right. It'll be quite conservative.
Keep in mind that Kurtz himself was already being accused of pushing the centre-right party further right.
Yes, exactly.
Without this coalition with the far-right party.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. On top of that, I just wanted to add one little thing that's happened regarding Austria's new government that has already caused a little bit of controversy, which I find very funny, is so that this far-right party, the Freedom Party, can keep one of their campaign promises, Sebastian Kurz, as the new Chancellor of Austria, has agreed that Austria should extend citizenship to all German speakers in South Tyrol, a region of Italy that was taken from Austria after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a part of Italy since 1919.
Yes.
Which Italy's not happy about, and a lot of people in the world are kind of concerned about, because it's coming from a party that might be sympathetic with some expansionist views.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I find it funny that they've had a government for a couple of days and they've already managed to cause a bit of a tiff with their neighbor. So that's great.
Well, I mean, sure. Great. The Czech Republic have also formed a government. This is kind of old news at this point, but again, the government people, not quite the government people expected. People were expecting Babiš to look for that he form a coalition was what a lot of was a lot of speculation. I think in the Czech Republic this is less of a surprise, but he's now going to run a minority government where they control 78 of the 200 seats. So it's kind of, they need, 12 plus one for most, 22 plus one for most stuff they want to do. But it seems is relatively stable. But I think it's the unusual thing about it is that the president, Zeman, is very pro Babiš, which is effectively, his whole shtick before the election was that even if Babiš is in prison, I'm still accepting his application to be prime minister. I'll name him prime minister regardless, how small their majority or forming coalition is, which is somewhat problematic in a lot of ways. But see what happens, I guess.
Oh dear. Smaller thing now is just this whole thing with Poland and the EU is continued to escalate while we were away.
One might argue that it's escalated because we've been away.
Ah, yes. Coalition is causation.
Coalition is causation.
God damn it. Correlation. Oh, I've said coalition way too many times in my life now, thanks to this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the triggering of Article 7 happened, and it's the atomic option, as it's often called, or the nuclear option, which suspends voting rights for Poland.
Yes.
And this is all due to some sketchy stuff they're doing with their judiciary, which we will cover later in this episode, to a certain extent.
Cover is a strong word.
Cover is a strong word. We've covered it in the past, all right? Don't self-defeat here, come on. A little bit of this has backfired for the EU, as the Czech Republic and Hungary the Czech Republic and Hungary have both vetoed the decision of Article 7 being implemented on Poland.
Yes.
So that's interesting.
Does that mean it just won't happen? Is that it?
So as far as I know, it's kind of the Article 7 has happened.
Right.
But the actual individual sanctions and what those are have been promised to be vetoed by Hungary and Czech Republic.
Yeah, because Article 7 is very much we're going to start looking into whether or not we need to impose voting right restrictions. It's not it immediately suspends all voting rights. It's very much the
lever you pull to spring Poland out of Europe.
Whereas the Czech Republic and Poland are saying that we're going to block actual sanctions and stuff.
Yeah. We're going to effectively make it meaningless.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, see if that holds up.
Interesting, because we covered this earlier in the year, it's interesting that Slovakia hasn't come to Poland's aid.
Ooh, contentious.
Ooh, contentious. Anyway. a date has been announced for next year's Italian elections. It's going to be going ahead in March 4th. So maybe before when the new year starts, we'll do a preview of the new year with all the list of elections. But I so far haven't assembled that list of all elections that are happening next year.
The Italian elections, hopefully, hopefully what?
Hopefully less than this year.
Yeah, there were a lot of elections this year. Yeah. Some of which not consequential, but there was a lot of consequential elections. Italian one will be particularly interesting because they've made some like relatively large changes to like the composition and how of the houses and like how the Italian voting system works that like will have an impact on the results. So it'll be interesting to see like if there are end up being big changes. So
interesting. The other thing is that Italy has kind of been avoiding this. The polls have been showing for a very long time that the five-star movement is quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
And Italy has managed to avoid that actually manifesting in any real way because they haven't had an election.
Yeah, right.
And that will be interesting in itself, whether the polls will change as campaigning starts, etc., etc. And then it's also interesting because Italy is a big country in the European Union. They are, with the UK gone, they are the third biggest member.
Yep. Which is big.
Which is significant. If anyone remembers our coverage immediately after Brexit, the previous Prime Minister of Italy was really asserting himself in European affairs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, Renzi. Yeah. He's now since stepped down, but...
Or we might see the return of Renzi.
We might see the return of Renzi. Or Berlusconi.
Yeah, it's still unclear as to whether or not he's eligible to run. Anyway.
We'll find out soon, I'm sure.
Oh, God. Maybe he changed his face. Maybe he got that new face because he didn't want people to... He was hoping no one would realize who he was.
Really weird Italian constitutional law with the phrasing says you can't run the same face twice or something.
That'd be good. The Germany. Yeah, the German coalition talks are still ongoing. The original promise by Angela Merkel was like, hopefully by Christmas. Obviously that hasn't happened, but that was for the... assuming the Jamaica coalition worked out, which it didn't. So now they're in talks with the Social Democrats, who they've been pushing like relatively heavily on and off for, oh, could there not just be a confidence supply deal or a minority government that we like super promise not to have a no confidence vote in?
super promise.
Yeah, whereas the CDU are very hellbent on not that. Basically they're saying that would be too unstable, which you know, arguments either way, but you need to convince the SPD to join a government otherwise, so I mean there's that. And Schulz is now quite like heavily saying that they would get the finance ministry if there was another grand coalition. That would be their goal of the negotiations. So like,
everyone wants that finance ministry, man.
They do.
It's like that Tears for Fear song.
Everybody
wants a finance ministry. I'm sorry, I thought there was a joke there. There isn't.
No, there is. It didn't need the singing bit.
I also, to add to the CDU's point that a confidence supply deal might be unstable, I mean, oh what, like 2 years of doing this podcast now?
Yeah.
It's hard to argue with that. The UK confidence supply deal didn't work out, and Ireland's probably having other elections next year.
What are you talking about? The UK deal's firm and strong and stable. It's strong and stable, Kieran.
Strong, stable, red, white, blue, hard, you know, all those great things.
Green. Speaking of the UK minority government, Theresa May can't get things through the parliament. It's very funny.
It is.
They tried to get through like their big Brexit kind of like packaging up loads of EU legislation as a British legislation deal without an amendment that Parliament gets to vote on the final agreement. And like, there's enough people in the Conservative Party that wanted this, and basically everyone else in the Parliament wanted it as well. Whereas Theresa May doesn't want it, but she thinks it undermines her negotiations, which it does. And she couldn't get a pass without that amendment, so it's in the law now, I guess. And they're like the next big thing that they want to push against is Theresa May wants there to be like a fixed date, and basically everyone else is like, no, we want the negotiations to go on as long as they need. And there's kind of, yeah, that might not work out either. So that's, yes. Also, speaking of her ridiculous government, two humorous things Boris Johnson did that are national embarrassments that would get lots of foreign ministers fired on some level.
If they weren't Boris Johnson.
Yeah, and allegedly, you know, difficult to get rid of or something.
I feel like Boris Johnson has, like... You know, like, it really does feel like the cabinet are a bunch of underage kids. Mm-hmm. And Boris Johnson just has a fake ID, so he gets them all drink, and that's the only reason they put up with him.
Yeah, he's like the school bully who weirdly has a bunch of friends who don't seem to like him, but are like, you know, we'll be like, we can't get rid of Boris. That would be mean.
He's the UK government's Cartman.
Yes, that's it. Except he's more problematic on the international stage than Cartman.
That's a hard ask.
He's done it though. The two things he did, one of them is just funny, which was there's a video of him on the phone with some Japanese dignitaries, and Boris is drinking some juice or like soda from near the Fukushima plant that had the big meltdown after the tsunami, and it's just Boris Johnson being like, it's actually very good. It's like, Boris, you could have, like, some of these things just work better with words than you doing something silly and like drinking it.
Boris Johnson ventures into prop comedy.
Yeah, then there was him and Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and it was just like the clearest demonstration of in their joint press conference of Lavrov is like a pretty well put together, you know, clearly skilled negotiator. Well versed in international diplomacy, and Boris Johnson just kept trying to crack jokes that didn't land, or like make jokes about Russian hacking he made a weird comment about like how kettle crisps have become really popular in Russia and they're like a great British export, and Lavrov was trying to say like international tensions between Russia and the UK are problematically high, and he was just kind of going on about, oh yes, but exports. I was like, Boris, read the room.
This isn't a kettle chips moment.
No.
God damn it. Yeah, it's a weird one.
I think.
He's generally just incompetent.
I'm not even shocked anymore. It's just I think it's his supernatural nuclear juice powers
that he has gained, yes, from the Fukushima water.
I think he's got mind control powers from all of his
I feel like just one day we're going to be driving in like the UK and we're just going to see him with a backpack like hitchhiking down the road while that like Hulk ending credits music plays. It's that Fukushima water, man.
Anyway, I think we're pretty caught up on the world, and by world I mean Europe specifically, and
that is everything that happened in Europe. Exactly everything. Nothing else happened.
We did not scrap an equal number of of news articles that we decided were either not high enough impact or we didn't have time to talk about.
For the first time on this podcast, we're going to do a year in review.
Yeah, we could have done one last year, but we didn't.
We did because we didn't do a full year last year, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, but we could have done a year of like events in review, not necessarily a year of the podcast in review.
Yeah, and at the same time, we just didn't think of it. So that's the real answer here, Hugh.
Instead, what we did last year is we did a 2017 preview episode.
Yes. I'm still doing that in the first normal episode back in 2018.
Yeah, no, we definitely can. I'm just saying, like, I think, yeah, we did that. Anyway, not important. as a precursor to this, I just want to talk about, there's an article on Euronews, which was which MEP's Facebook posts got the most emoji reactions in 2017. This being, yep, for people who don't use Facebook, on Facebook now, they don't just have a like button. If you like hold, click, or hold, tap on the button, you can select a number of different reactions, like love, or wow, or angry. And this,
I angry your post.
Yeah, right. So this, it breaks it down by what type of reaction it had. Like, it, mm-hmm, was it a like? Which ones had the most wows? Which one had the most loves? Etc. Which ones had the most sad? So I think this, I just wanted to bring this up, is this is a good sample of the decline of our democracy into a social media hellscape.
Also, the new season of Black Mirror came out today.
Oh, I wonder if this is actually viral marketing for that.
It's one of those what was that stupid in content marketing or something.
Yeah, oh, maybe that's that.
This entire article was paid for by Charlie Brooker.
Yeah, personally paid for it. Netflix wouldn't cough up the money, but he was like, no, it's very important, but Charlie, doesn't say Black Mirror anywhere on it. That's not important, they'll get it. Anyway, right, I strongly recommend people go read it, because it's a very confusing combination of nonsense.
You suspect this is something to do with the fact that NBC now owns like a controlling or a large share of Euronews.
I forget if it's controlling or not, but yeah. So anyone who like frequents Euronews, especially the TV channel, there's a lot more syndicated from NBC stuff. Yeah. Which, like, you know, makes sense if they, you know, share material. I'm sure the opposite happens as well, but...
Oh, totally, yeah, yeah.
I think it's just the tone of NBC stuff is so off what Euronews is.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, like, sensationalization is, like... It's even, like, NBC is a pretty, like, neutral, relatively American news source, but it's just, like, combined to Euronews, which is very sedate as a comparison.
I really like I just like how you said it. It's like, if you watch Euronews TV channel, you'll see a lot of NBC syndicated content, like classic episodes of Friends. Could I be any more wearing your clothes? And like, cut to ad break, the fighting still continues in East Ukraine.
What's the deal with Europe?
It's not working. It's and not working. Don't put on that episode, yeah, of 30 Rock.
Then it, cuts, then it cuts that old Euronews segment of just like, it was the no comment section, which is just just like very well shot photojournalism and video journalism with no presenter. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like that, and then it cuts the shouting person on NBC.
Oh god. Total inconsistencies.
Yeah. It's just notable that, you know, it's, yeah, different.
Actual, anyway. Now we're going to do Previously in Europe Presents, drum roll, da, 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 our year in review. Mm-hmm. Hooray!
Which episodes of the podcast had the most emoji reactions in 2017?
God damn it! okay.
Yeah.
So the year started with the European Parliamentary President debates.
Yes, which we were very excited about. And they lived up to standard.
They were very, very Euronewsy, not very NBC.
Yes, they were very much a reasoned discussion of problems and things that need to be sorted out in the EU Parliament, especially surrounding reasonable ways you could do reforms within the Parliament to change voting, yeah, structures, etc.
So the person who won that election was, uh-huh, Antonio Tajani,
yes,
who I have not heard anything from since.
No, I have. He says the odd thing.
He does.
He's,
yeah,
not. Yeah, he's not like a.
He's not Schultz.
No, that's the thing. He's not Schultz in that. He's a lot like he. I think he has less. He's a lot more kind of background European deal making kind of guy,
yeah,
to get elected, whereas Schultz is a lot more, I like to give speeches that are big grandstanding things, whereas Tajani, yeah, that was Tajani's like marketing point. It was like kind of like he would be the traditional choice for parliament president, and he
so yeah if you,
he won,
yeah, if you split Schultz and Tajani down like in the whole conservative progressive, but in the sense of like where we think Europe should, like what role we think Europe should play and like EU should play in European politics.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, Tajani's just like, it was really good back in like the early 90s, late 80s when the European Union just like ruled on consumer laws. That was it. And,
I think it's more like,
no, people should know what's happening and Europe should kind of operate kind of like a country government.
Yeah. So in some way, Tajani was kind of like a disappointing pick for... From the view of like EU transparency, for instance, of kind of like, it's not that Tajani wants to be like obstructive, it's that like he's relatively conservative, he's like, he's kind of like well versed in the EU machine and kind of how the, you know, committees and stuff work, which isn't really like, you know, big sweeping changes, hopey changey stuff. But yeah, he seems fine.
We're going to keep saying this small point until it happens, but Cyprus didn't reunify this year.
They had, like, I think two separate reunification talks, neither of which anything came up. And I think, like, it's kind of like Turkey's relationship with everybody else kind of declined more and more as this year went on, and you basically need Turkey to play ball in a lot of ways. And kind of like the... There was a more recent thing where Erdogan made suggestions that part of Greece should be in Turkey. So it's kind of like, he doesn't think that their other borders are a done deal. So getting him to agree on anything really into Cyprus is, as I can see why it's not going anywhere.
Similarly speaking to Turkey, jumping a little bit ahead in the year, there was the Turkish referendum, which gave a lot of like new sweeping powers to Erdogan. I guess Turkey this year is marred by declining relationships with the rest of Europe.
Also, like,
and when we say Cyprus had like two talks this year, they had two rounds of talks. They went on for both times quite a while.
Like, touching on it briefly before we talk about it properly, the, like, there was the whole thing of like, there was the scandals in Germany of like trying to bar various Turkish diplomats from traveling to Germany for fears that they would try and like electioneer in the German referenda or in the German election. So it was kind of, you know, not a great year for Turkey's relationship with other places, but good year for Erdogan personally.
There was a lot of protests in Romania over corruption, charges, and the current government trying to skirt around various corruption rulings and laws.
They basically, like, in order for them to join the EU and kind of like in general, they had to strengthen their anti-corruption laws, etc. Whereas the current government, because they their members keep getting arrested and jailed for corruption, are now that they're in power and like very firmly in power, are trying to edge in like weakening to the anti-corruption stuff. They're selling it as like a controlling prison population thing, but it's, you know, we know, and the Romanian people know, there's been pretty much continuous protests. Like every couple of weeks you'll check on it, and there were large-scale protests in Romania, and the reason it didn't make news was because it wasn't quite as big as the previous round of protests. And it's just because like originally, they were trying to just like push this through, like with very, very straightforward legislation. Then they tried to sneak it on, connected to other things. Now they're trying to, then they were trying to push it through as like a change to the constitution, which needed like more support. It's kind of like them trying every which way to make it push through.
Yeah, it's the thing that I found most shocking about this like thing that happened in Romania, pretty much for the entire year. It was happening all year kind of thing, but it was just dependent on whether English-speaking media covered it. The thing I find most shocking about it is just how transparent it is. Like how transparently like corrupt the process is, or like the goal is.
I think there's an interesting thing of like that we don't, like, as in there is like in a lot of countries, there is kind of like a expectation of like, oh, we know like this part of our government is corrupt, or there's these corrupt aspects to it. But I feel like, especially in a lot of Eastern Europe, when you talk to people from that country, they like in no uncertain terms are like, no, the entire government currently is like incredibly corrupt, and it like bleeds down to like many layers into the civil service, and it's not like it's a symptom of a lot of ex-Soviet places that didn't fully get rid of in like as complete a way as they possibly could have the corrupt elements that like became pervasive due to the way the Soviet Union worked in those countries. And kind of not that the same people are involved, but it's like the expectation of, oh, this part of the government is obviously corrupt, and you're like,
it's almost the same system.
Yeah, basically. It's like that's not really the way, like the city, it not being surprising to a lot of Romanians that the government are trying to change the jail terms for corruption charges so that many of their party members get reduced jail terms.
Yeah,
and that they're protesting it because they know it's wrong, but it's not like a shock. Whereas, like, I think in places like the UK, it's more, it's a much smaller group of people where you're saying like, oh, there's an aristocratic class that do have a lot of like unfair sway on how a lot of stuff works, but overall, it does generally work as a democracy in a lot of ways, and there's less need for like mass protests for what otherwise would be like quite administrative legislation, but in Romania they're making it quite sweeping.
Yeah, I think also there's might be something to say that you could, like, when it is shocking, when something like that happens, that it is shocking to the populace, they can almost be shocked out of protest.
Yeah.
Whereas, because this kind of reminds me of a lot of things happening in Ireland around Repeal of the Eighth, where the reason the protests are so vocal and so active and so on the streets is because the idea that our government might just, you know, keep the Eighth Amendment or install something that we would kind of view as a draconian abortion laws, that's not shocking to the Irish population,
because it's like in a similar way of like very like pro big corporation, currently rich people stuff in the UK isn't shocking. It's like people protest against it and shout loudly about it, but it's like that's not shocking. Whereas like in Romania, it's the we need to protest against this, but it's not shocking that there's mass corruption in because like a lot of these people have been around for so long and have been embroiled in so many scandals over the years. It's like, well, we know like the head of the current Romanian ruling party isn't running the country because he's ineligible due to having been convicted of rigging an election by the anti-corruption laws that he's trying to weaken via his like somewhat puppet government. And you're like, well, that seems like a ludicrous situation. We all have our own version of it, but that version of it sounds terrible.
This is happening and you're telling me he doesn't work for a bank? This seems weird.
Where's his top hat? I don't understand.
He's not a lord. Okay.
It's funny because it's like the difference of like in so many countries you have the lying to the working class aspect of a lot of these things, whereas in the UK it has like the more old school of, oh no, it's the rich people and they know exactly what's going on, and all the working class people like generally are aware that this is a problem and are still more of a stronghold for the left than it is in a lot of other countries, which is, it's always interesting. I think it's like it's places where the far right has more of a hold is always interesting to me, because it's actually just like, oh, it's a really different version of what is like the same core problem, but it's like, as in there's corruption going on, but as in your version of corruption is just, it's very different.
Well, it's what happened in the States with the drain the swamp concept, where it's like that's the main campaign point that Donald Trump had that I would agree with. It's just, I don't think you're the man to do it.
Yeah, and I don't think your intentions are what you say they are.
Yeah. So it's like, we need to decouple business from the government. So elect me, a businessman. Anyway, the Dutch elections happened.
Yes.
Which were funny.
They were especially funny because there was like a continuous stream of like kind of man on the street Dutch people being interviewed by various media organizations, and the number one salient point that consistently came out, whether it was like someone who was going to vote for Geert Wilders, the far right guy that was drawing all the attention to it, whether they were going to vote for him or not, the constant response was just, why are you all paying attention to our election? What do you think is going to happen? Because for some reason, it was like a lot of American media and like UK media and stuff who would not give a shit about the Dutch election normally, like pooled into the Netherlands to be like, Geert Wilders is going to win. Is he going to win? He could win, right? And everyone was like, no, you've misunderstood polling in the Netherlands completely.
Or like the concept that our parliament is always super fragmented, yeah, and this is just how the Netherlands works.
Yeah, because there was a brief point where it was like, oh, Geert Wilders' party is like ahead in the polls. And it's like, yeah, but you need to understand that all the Dutch polling has like, it was like 60 something percent of people were undecided in all that polling, so you were like, yeah, oh, he's ahead within the small sliver of the voting block of like of likely voters who said they're gonna vote, and it's like, oh, surprise surprise, the fringe parties have their like ardent supporters.
Yeah, it was, I guess, a lot of particularly British and American media outlets viewed it as a litmus test.
Yes.
Was Brexit, was Trump going to continue? Yeah. Was this far-right sweep going to happen in Western Europe? It always happened in Eastern Europe. We don't need to pay attention to that. Is it going to happen in Western Europe?
They're not,
is it going to continue happening?
They're not indicative of anything, but the Netherlands, the enormous population and footprint of the Netherlands is the clear litmus test for whether or not the far-right will sweep Europe.
Well, there is that concept of the Dutch effect where, like, they were one of the first countries to like legalize same-sex marriage, and they also have had pretty lax weed laws for a very long time, and then X amount of years later that's happened in other countries.
I think it was just like people were like, sweet, that election made us loads of news money, let's cover more elections. Oh, this Geert Wilders guy seems crazy.
Why does he look like a Bond villain? Anyway,
also he's quite tan for how anti-migrant he is. Is he Dutch?
I feel like he looks exactly what I would draw a villain as when I was a teenager, like writing comics.
Yeah,
that's what my villains looked like. Was Geert Wilders?
Interesting. Perhaps you have some sort of Nostradamus powers.
I really hope not. My comics were buck wild. Anyway, the French presidential elections happened.
This was also hilarious.
Which Hugh added to the list, rightfully so, because for the first year, like, ever, what a lot of French people were saying is that the French elections had become Americanized.
Yes.
There was, like, big public primary debates with the big, like, major parties in France. People paid a lot of attention to the primaries of the major two parties. Mm-hmm. And that went on for a very long time, and they talked about the French presidential elections earlier this year.
Yeah.
Like you get to the point now where when you're 2 years into a presidency in the United States, you start talking about the next election.
Yeah.
And that's like, for any American listeners, that's considered nuts in Europe.
Yeah. In fact, like a lot, an awful lot of countries, like France included, don't have a set election date that is going to happen at a fixed time. It's like, it's more of a, oh, you're near the end of your term, you have like within this period of time, we know roughly when the election will be, but it's not like a countdown to the organized primary start that we know is happening a year prior to the election.
Yeah,
like the French,
most countries, a lot of European countries operate with like windows.
Whereas the French thing happened like 4 months before the election was when all the primaries were, and there was a couple of months prior to that of campaigning in the primaries when people were like announcing and stuff. But realistically, like people could have run in as an independent with much shorter notice, they just wouldn't have gotten this long tail. As it turned out, like, the long tail ended up amounting to nothing, because we already knew Marie Le Pen would run, and that she that there was a good chance she'd make it to the second round, which she did. François Fillon was elected nominated by his party, and the assumption at the time was like, oh, he'll definitely win. Which
the assumption was whoever the Les Républicains picked,
unless it was Sarkozy, which it like there was a point at which they were like there was the speculation because there was so much speculation around everything. It was like, oh, maybe Sarkozy will be the nominee again. It was like, no, he's very unpopular.
I mean, it could happen, but I really hope.
Yeah,
not.
and like kind of it was very much a if he became the nominee, I don't think he'll win because
he was the only because we talked about this when this was happening. They do polling relatively well in France, where they have a lot of, because they do that two-stage runoff presidential election. Yeah. They poll a lot of possible combinations of like this person versus that person. So I think Sarkozy was the only Les Républicains candidate that was like a serious consideration, which was after Fillon and Juppé. It was then Sarkozy. Mm-hmm. Who was like, and he was the only like Les Républicains candidate that wasn't beating Le Pen in a landslide. In some polls he beat her,
but
in others he didn't.
It would have been a close election. Of there was a lot of like very anti-Sarkozy people who would be like, Marie Le Pen seems like the reasonable choice.
Oh God, Sarkozy, get it together!
Yeah, one of the things that brought him down was he was currently under investigation at the time by French prosecutors because some of his money may have in his previous election campaign may have illegally come from Gaddafi.
Jesus.
So that's fun. And then
the ghost of Gaddafi haunts here.
Yeah, and then it turned out not to matter anyway, because Fillon didn't even make it to the second round. So it doesn't... And Macron, who everyone was like up far, like quite far through the primary nonsense, it was kind of like, this guy Macron is running, and he has some support, but like, it might be like he'll get like 10% or something. And then closer to the actual election, it was, Macron could... Macron could scrape into the second round, but because no one had really considered this was a possibility for quite a while, it was but if Macron gets into the second round, like, Le Pen could win, right? Like, Fillon is a safe choice, and then Fillon was embroiled in a scandal where his wife was on his staff.
Penelope Gate!
Yeah, Penelope Gate, and...
Yay.
People were unclear as to whether or not she actually did the job he said she was doing, or whether or not it was just a way for Fionn's family to double his money from his job. Which, you know, whether or not that's true, the selling point of Fionn was that he was scandal-free, and then it turned out Macron was actually scandal-free.
Yeah, it was super interesting because there was a lot of speculation, Macron mightn't be able to... go toe-to-toe with Le Pen. Mm. But, like, from very early days, because of good French polling, where they had actually polled a lot of people, all the combinations, Macron versus Le Pen, he always, like, there was no poll where he lost that, as far as I remember.
Yeah, because it was... People were concerned he was too, like, tarnished with having been, like, in Hollande's government, but it was very much like, but the things he did in Hollande's government were actually quite palatable to Les Républicains voters, and, like, a lot of the socialist voters... wouldn't vote against him for Le Pen for that reason, so that's covering most of the population. And Macron had a sweeping victory.
Yeah, the Republican Front, as it's known in France, is quite strong.
Yeah.
Which is just the grouping of people who is just like, no matter what happens, we don't let the FN in.
Yeah. So he had a sweeping victory, then he got a sweeping victory in the parliamentary elections as well, and then Macron runs everything.
Yes, they annexed Germany and now it's fine. Macron runs everything. Speaking of Hollande and his government, while he was a quote-unquote lame duck president, and I mean, it's hard to argue against that title when what I'm about to describe very few people cared about, and it happened while like unveiling a new train line, which is like, I don't know, that's not presidential work, I feel. Anyway, one of his security guards accidentally fired his sniper.
Yeah.
Like, nowhere near Halland. Because he's still alive. Yeah. You'd hear about that if that happened. Yeah. But it's a really funny video to watch if you haven't seen it, because it's just some, like, a gunshot going off and the smallest reaction from everyone in shot of the camera.
Yeah.
No one jumps in front of Halland, or no one pulls him out of the way. He barely reacts. He slightly pivots on the podium that he's on. And I think he makes a quip after that. I can't remember. But so if that sniper had been anyway pointing at Halland, Halland would be dead. That's what would have happened.
Funny. Martin Schulz made us promises that he would not be their candidate for chancellor, and then he was elected party leader, and he was like, maybe, and then he became their candidate for chancellor, and he was like, oh, me? You want me? What? No, crazy.
Unfortunately, he proved to be quite disappointing as a candidate. With
SPD's worst vote share ever.
Yeah, Jesus. That was bad. Considering a lot of people were very excited for him as like a pro-European candidate.
Yeah.
But it was the German population of Reddit, like, even clung to him as like the anti-Trump.
Yeah, there was the Schulz Reddit, which was combating
modeled after the Donald.
I think it was a similar problem of like, because he announced all this stuff incredibly early. So like the German elections were in September, October. And like Schulz announced and started campaigning in like April or something. Like, it was kind of the French presidential election happened and Schulz was on the campaign trail basically immediately, and basically people just stopped covering it after a while because Schulz would say crazy stuff that people would kind of agree was probably unlikely to happen, and Merkel wouldn't comment on it because she would say stuff like, her response would just be, I'm running the country, I don't have time to comment on everything Schulz says.
Yeah.
And
so like while France had like pushed their campaigning date early and earlier, Germany was just like, nah, not having any of that shit.
But Schulz kind of tried his hand at that. He was on the campaign trail hard. He gave a lot of speeches, like, kind of, and he would come up with policy proposals that would have been interesting news if Merkel or any of his other opponents bothered to comment on it. But because he was basically like, he was campaigning way before Merkel's
campaigning in a vacuum.
Yeah, though. Merkel's like plan effectively was not really to campaign that much. And like,
she didn't need to.
Yeah, but if Schulz had started like hard campaigning much, much later, and it was notable then that he had started campaigning, and it was close enough to the election that you could argue, oh, well, Merkel not campaigning is odd now. That would be a different situation. But like in April for a September election, Merkel saying like, I'm not campaigning against, like, I'm busy, I have things, the criticism would just be, I'm not running the country. And then he had a very like lackluster debate performance against her, possibly because he was exhausted from the months and months of campaigning.
So it's probably too early to say. This isn't really part of retrospective, but I have been slightly a bit more impressed with him as like negotiating the SPD's role in a coalition or government.
Yes.
I think he's played that quite well.
Yes.
But he was terrible on the actual federal, like, Bundestag election campaign.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah, the CDU lost seats, the SPD lost seats, somewhat to a far-right party and in equal measure to the liberal party. And the Greens made a little bit of a gain as well. So then there was originally going to be a Jamaica coalition, which was going to be Merkel and the Liberals and the Greens, and the Liberals made crazy demands, like, we want the finance ministry and we want loads of sway in the government. It was like, but you have like 10% of the vote, as you have the same number of votes share as the Greens basically, and you want a lot more than they want, and they're not happy with
we suspect that happened because there were some polls in Germany that would indicate before the election that the FDP would be more of a kingmaker than they were.
Yes.
Like, they would be more crucial in coalition building than they turned out to be.
Yes.
Once the Greens got invited as well, which then when people started to examine the policy points of both these two parties, which seemed oddly diametrically opposed. Like, you don't usually think I think in most other countries you're like, okay, the centrist Liberal Party and the like further left Green Party, they'd have some ground to cover. Like, they have some overlap, surely. And then in Germany it's just like,
no. They had some, but not enough. They had a lot.
Their key points were like in contrast with one another.
Yeah. So that happened. Yeah. They're still negotiating a government. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
The EU finally brought in no roaming charges for mobile phones. That was cool.
Woo!
That's been promised for a long time. It just finally worked out.
That had been promised for a long time, yes. Yeah. So that's nice that happened. Made the Spain trip easier.
Oh, I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I spent way too much time talking about the Liechtenstein election.
You did.
As part of this podcast policy that I never consulted Hugh in and have kind of just enforced, of no election left behind.
Except for elections we forget about until the day before.
Whoops.
but Ciaran made sure to be big on the Liechtenstein election, population of 60,000.
We got some good jokes out of it, like the likelihood that you are running for.
Yeah, that percentage was high. The Northern Ireland hasn't had a government since March. So the Northern Irish national or the provincial government, I guess, has a lot of power. Like, they control a lot of stuff, and it's very much like its existence is very much integral to the Northern Irish peace that exists between the Republicans and Unionists. But they haven't been able to work out a government since March, which is, you know, more of a problem than you think so, because there were UK elections as well, and the UK elections basically ended up with the Conservative Party were very confident that they would do very well in the elections and come out with an increased majority, because the whole thing was that they had a very, very slim majority in the Parliament, and that was slightly problematic because there were a lot of very loud minority voices getting a lot of sway in the government. So Theresa May had a lot of very strong pro-Brexit people in her cabinet that she couldn't get rid of because there were too many pro-Brexit MPs that she needed to keep in line and vote with her, so she had an election to
and it went swimmingly. Sorry, over
which caused them to lose 20 something seats. So they went from a majority of 11 or 12 to being 11 or 12 short of a majority. And then they got the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, to prop them up with a confidence supply deal, which was a massive cash cow for Northern Ireland.
Yes, and maybe a constitutional crisis if you pay enough attention to it. If you don't bring it up, it's fine.
True that.
Yeah.
So that happened. That was funny. Brexit has been ongoing. There's been a series of negotiations that haven't gone well. The UK are yet to say what they want as negotiating goals, which is continuously a problem, and I think will remain a problem until they stop doing that.
A hot take prediction of 2018.
Yeah, so effectively the Brexit negotiations go on the topic of freedom of movement. The UK or the EU will say we prefer there just to be freedom of movement if we can work out some other agreements. The UK will be like, no, we don't want that. And it's like, okay, cool, what's your counter offer?
Oh no.
Or when it's most apparent when they're talking about, okay, so we both agree there's going to be some sort of transfer of funds to make up the money for your obligations. We think it's roughly around 60-70 billion. The UK will say, that's too much. Okay, well, what do you think's a fair amount of money? Silence.
EU doesn't want a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. UK is like, no, we'll have some form of border. It's like, cool, what will it look like? Silence.
Yeah, it's been fun. Russia wasn't in the Eurovision?
Yes, yeah, due to visa problems and the fact that this year's 2017's Eurovision was held in a country they have shaky relations with, or an ongoing war with, depending on your outlook.
I think the podcast's position is that it's a war.
Yeah. But it's not like people just... I feel like the news still has to call it a conflict, because it's It's not like a Russo-Ukrainian war outright. It's just Ukraine versus a bunch of rebels in their very impoverished east who seem to be getting weapons from somewhere, who knows, kind of thing.
Yeah, but in the same way that the first Afghanistan war was the Soviet Union versus the Taliban brought to you by America.
Yes.
This is Ukraine versus some Ukrainians who don't think they're Ukrainians anymore, brought to you by Russia.
Brought to you by Russia. Because Russia's Eurovision entry had performed in Crimea after it was annexed by Russia, and that Eurovision, that singer had entered the country without the permission of Kiev, Kiev was like, you are barred from entering Ukraine. This is a policy they do with everyone. If I were to go to Crimea tomorrow without the permission of Kiev, I would be banned from entering Ukraine proper.
Or, like, for the sake of balance, the other way of looking at it was, a Russian citizen went to Russia, and therefore Ukraine didn't let them into Ukraine.
Yes, you could balance. fuck's sake. Yeah, that,
previously
that's,
in Europe,
I'm sure,
fair and balanced. We're taking it back.
That Kieran, too left-leaning.
I'm going to wear a bow tie. But it'll be great.
We're neoconservatives now.
That's us.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you bastards. Anyway.
My boots don't have any straps.
Yeah, that sounds like a conspiracy to me. Do you know who I blame? The libs. Anyway. Sorry. Yeah, so that happened, and I'm pretty sure it was, like, totally planned by Russia to do this.
Oh, yeah.
And you might think...
probably.
Oh, okay, so, like, hearing this story, you might think, ah, no, that sounds like coincidence. Mm-hmm. Of course, like, a famous Russian singer would perform in what Russia sees as a part of Russia. That's not, like, unusual, right? But it's also worth noting that she's, like, a sweet young girl who's in a wheelchair. She, like, ticks all the boxes possible to make Ukraine look like a monster.
Yeah.
So that was a fun Eurovision.
Also,
Portugal won it, by the way, for the first time ever.
Yeah, and then the winner followed his win by giving a speech about how shit Eurovision was.
Yeah, that's Hugh's takeaway from it.
But he did. That's what he did.
Yeah, he made a point that is like, oh, real music can still win. Yeah, I'm not sure he's like...
No,
yeah,
his point wasn't that... His point wasn't that music can still win. His point was that all previous Eurovision winners are shit.
I mean, that's one way of it. I would make the more generous position that he doesn't like the type of music that usually wins the Eurovision.
Or that always wins
that
the Eurovision.
But that type of music doesn't necessarily have to be in the Eurovision for him to not like it.
Yeah.
Right?
No, yeah, I guess. But, you know...
This is funnier to say he got on stage and slapped the Eurovision.
No, I would argue that your way of talking about it is... Yeah. Fairer on him in that, like, it's painted him in a more positive light than he's due, and my way of looking at it is more accurate. because his speech was effectively every other entrant in this year's Eurovision was illegitimate as music. It's not music. What I did was music.
Yeah. I still have the this year's Italian entry on my, like, most played on Spotify.
Yeah. The live performance of that was dire, though. Anyway.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Back to this.
Back to, yeah.
Speaking of dictatorial assholes, there was a...
Like that Portuguese entry.
Like that Portuguese entry in the Eurovision, what's-his-face. The Erdogan had a bit of a referendum in Turkey that wildly increased his powers. So yeah, there was that. That was fun. May 18th was the day that was the week that loads of governments collapsed.
Ireland, Austria, Kosovo, and the Netherlands still hadn't had a government after having an election very far in the past.
Yes.
However, like to be fair to the Dutch, that seems pretty normal.
Yeah.
That's part and parcel with having such a fragmented parliament.
Yes.
Yeah.
Austria's government collapsing was pretty dramatic, Kosovo's government collapsing wasn't like super surprising, but you know, based on the like agreements with the parties,
Kosovo's going to Kosovo.
Yeah, Ireland was the prime minister was like very suddenly had to leave, which was fun.
I must go now. My people need me.
My people need me out west.
Mayo.
Yeah.
So Enda Kenny, former Taoiseach of Ireland, resigned, and then a couple of months later, Leo Varadkar was elected as Ireland's new Taoiseach, which the whole world kind of reacted with, oh look, a person of non-Irish ethnic origin who is also openly gay is Ireland's Taoiseach, and the rest of Ireland was just like, yeah, so what? We didn't really elect him on those terms.
He's not that popular.
No. He's kind of an elitist snob.
Speaking of gay people, a lot of countries legalize same-sex marriage, which is cool. Malta, yes. Germany, and Austria.
Very different ways, though.
Yes. Yeah. Very different ways.
Malta voted in the parliament. Mm-hmm. Germany voted in the parliament in like a surprise, like. As far as I know, Malta had known this vote was coming for like a couple of weeks, but then Germany just kind of like pulled the rug and was like, yep, gay marriage is legal now. Yeah, woo! And Austria had a constitutional hiccup.
Yeah, basically, I think it was the result of a court case. And then like Kurz had just been elected and kind of said somewhat reluctantly that they were going to recognize that they were going to like, you know, push it through as totally fine, not going to contest it anyway. We learned some fun things about Jean-Claude Juncker our favorite EU technocrat. Juncker doesn't carry a smartphone. He has an old school Nokia of some description.
A fine European phone.
Yeah, I think we discovered this because I think he said it in an interview, and then subsequently at a press conference, his phone rang when he was supposed to be talking, and he looked at it and declined the call, and like kind of jokingly said, "Ha, it's probably my wife," and then declined the call, and then looked at it again, and it was like, "Oh no, it's Mrs. Merkel."
That was probably important.
Yeah. And then kind of awkwardly put it in his suit jacket. He gave an interview to a Belgian tabloid in which he revealed that he has a list of enemies.
Which I like to think, knowing these two pieces of information, this list of enemies is a collection of texts he saved that he sent himself. Because that was the only way you were able to keep lists on your phone back then.
I think he had a pocketbook. I think that was it.
Probably
because he had a name as well. I'm blanking on the name, but he had a pocketbook with a name that was his list of enemies. Also, he loves bees.
Bees. Ongoing stuff with Poland this year, which we kind of covered in the news roundup section just now, but yeah, Poland has been on shaky terms with the European Union for quite some time. Yes. Due to judicial stuff, the Polish people have also reacted with large-scale protests this year against the judicial reforms, a general protest against how the current government is operating, as well as, I believe very early on this year, protests against getting rid of their open abortion laws.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a lot of protests. It was good. There was the Woman Strike Day. Was that last year?
Yes, I think that was earlier this year. That was around the abortion stuff. That was all women had a general strike.
Yes.
Which was good. I like general strikes. They're always interesting.
I feel like we can skip over Catalonia because we've been talking about it consistently for like 10 weeks or something. People know. There was a Catalan thing where the Catalan government were all like, we're going to have an independence referendum. And Madrid were all like, no, you're not. And they were like, we've set a date. And Madrid were like, no, stop it. Stop it now. It's illegal. And they were all like,
the terrifying specter of death that is Tweety buried on the side of a cruise ship rolled into Barcelona.
Yeah, and there was a massive police crackdown during the quote unquote illegal referendum. And then the referendum passed with like some enormous percentage of the people who actually voted. But you have to factor in that people who wanted to stay independent, or no, stay as part of Spain, probably wouldn't have gone through the police barricades in a number of places to vote against it. Some of them did, because it didn't it didn't pass with like 100%, but it passed with like 80-something or 90-something. Anyway, then after that, the police crackdown continued, and they arrested the entire Catalan cabinet, except for Carles Puigdemont, the president? Was he president of Catalan? Or
because the title is president of the parliament.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, right. He fled to Belgium under very humorous circumstances, and has been in Belgium since.
Yep. We covered the Catalonia election just now. So if this is your first episode of Previously in Europe, what are you doing? This is a bad episode to start with, I'm sorry. But yeah, that was Catalonia this year.
There was a lot of stuff.
Speaking of more legitimate elections, the Czech and Austrian elections happened. Yes. The Austrian elections we've covered slightly. Kurz was voted in, and there is now a far right government in Austria. And the Czech government happened, where a Czech billionaire, Babiš, became Prime Minister of the Czech Republic. And that was all fine. The Czech government is now formed. And
Babiš was kind of sold as like a Czech Trump, but on a number of levels, Babiš seems like both a better businessman and like smarter than Trump, in that like,
yeah,
when you see him give speeches, like, I appreciate that I'm reading it with subtitles, it's not like a rambling mess. He kind of has a thing to say, and he says it like you would expect in some sort of business meeting.
He is the Czech Trump from the perspective of what Trump supporters think Trump is.
Sure. I think
there was also a funny moment when the Czech president, after Babiš's election, the president being separate but a supporter of Babiš, brought out a gun and waved it in front of a bunch of journalists because it's 2017. Why not?
The gun was a joke gun that said "for the press" or something on it.
I mean, that's not much better.
Might have been gold as well. Anyway,
was it a drink? Was it a drink dispenser? I feel like there was a bottle.
Maybe it was a whole thing of like, what is that? Why do you have it?
I don't feel like that was addressed properly by anyone.
No. And there was loads of sexual harassment this year, and by this year I mean consistently since time immemorial, but people have now decided to start talking about it, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And
which is a good thing.
There was an awful lot of like, oh, the EU as an institution has a lot of like sexual harassment problems, in the same way that any parliament does, but like the EU is so like enormous and bringing together of like so many people from different places, and like there's a lot of like junior staffers, that it kind of has a magnifying glass on it, a bit of like, not necessarily even MEPs being embroiled, but kind of how deep does the bureaucracy go, and such an enormous workplace as was known and is now more apparent, have, you know, sexual harassment problems. And
yeah, it's also worth noting from an English perspective, like from an English language speaking perspective and a European perspective, so a lot of the like sexual harassment things have been very like in our part of the news, like in our English speaking news, have been focused around the United States, their politicians and their actors,
and the UK. There's been at least one person leaving the cabinet for like what would be deemed inappropriate workplace conduct that isn't necessarily like sexually harassing a person, but cases of kind of, well, that's not like, you know, within the code of what you expect a minister to be doing.
But the point I was getting to, sorry, is that stuff has been happening in Europe, and proof of that is that a lot of our English speaking listeners might be familiar with the Me Too hashtag.
Yes.
That was actually started in France.
Yeah, and had a lot of traction in France.
Yes, yeah. Like, it was translated so that it works in French. But, yeah, that started in France. Yeah.
And
the idea was picked up by the English-speaking world.
That Alyssa Milano, man, she's a... she's a hashtag-stealing witch. I don't mean witch in a derogatory way. I mean it in her popular Charm television show way.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Can't
yeah,
say
yeah.
enough positive for Liz Milano. She's cool.
So that was our year in review. We left out a lot of the like more depressing stuff and focused on hilarious things.
Yeah. Some of which wasn't hilarious.
Some of it was kind of tragic, but yeah, we in light of our podcast, we have, if anyone hasn't noticed, we've kind of started ignoring more explicitly acts of terrorism. For the reasons that I'm going to reiterate again, is that we don't feel like we're competent enough to cover it responsibly. Hey. I'm sorry, Hugh. I wasn't really directed at you. It was like, but if Hugh wasn't here, I'd totally
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, right. I would cover it, but I can't trust this guy to not, like, say something inappropriate. No, it's generally, it's more like around when something happens that, for instance, like on its scale is notable, but like there is crime every day that often is like bigger impact than the act of terrorism. And on top of that, the terrorist incidents, especially, like, not especially this year, but like also this year, tend to become all-encompassing of the news in basically the most, like, the English language media, certainly, especially due to like the influence of American media, isn't kind of like stuff that happens in France doesn't get covered really at all in America unless there's a terrorist incident, in which case it's, there's loads of terrorism happening in France, look at it, let's all look at it now. And it's kind of we're kind of, the point of this podcast was like stuff that happens in Europe that doesn't necessarily get covered as heavily, or like a different perspective of looking at it. Whereas I guess we feel that that kind of stuff gets covered unless there's like a very specific, like like additional relevance on top of how it's covered, or if we want to talk about how it's possibly been miscovered, that's also notable. But I guess we don't need to reiterate the facts because they both got their fair due, and on top of it, that's sort of the point of terrorism in a lot of ways, is that this thing is going to happen and it's all everyone's going to talk about, and it'll give you the recency, like you'll have a recency effect of it of, oh, well, there's loads of terrorism because that's all I hear about.
Yeah, yeah. So like terrorism as its main goal is to instill fear and panic, and the media doesn't help that. And this year, I think it was either this year or late last year, we had the like French newspapers deciding that they would no longer like name the terrorists involved or show their faces in their newspapers. Yeah,
three or four of the major newspapers came together and said that.
Yeah, which as a point is something I kind of also agree with, which is why I don't want to do it either, because most of the time, whenever you actually sit down like an expert on terrorism, like for a media interview, this happens on like Sky News like an uncomfortable amount of times. The final point he always leaves with is that terrorism perpetuates itself by like continuous coverage by the news.
Yeah, especially like the existing brand of like Islamic terrorism, where there no longer exists like a like single organization to point to that's like a unified training camp.
Yeah.
Like the old fear was people would go to the Pakistani mountains or Afghanistan and get trained by the Taliban after having previously been radicalized, whereas the focus now is of, oh, they it's now more difficult for them to do that, and that organization structure doesn't really exist anymore. So now the brand of things that you get is a focus on what is a much more difficult to stop kind of attack, which is people who were independently radicalized for some sort of cause, be it a misunderstanding of Islam or far right, often racially motivated attacks against Muslims, or just like very, very staunch anti, like very, very specific political positions from the murder of the MP in the UK, Joe Cox, wasn't like, that's not tieable to like that individual being like trained by someone somewhere and sent here to do something organized. It was him planning to do something himself and explaining his thought process of getting there and naming him and putting his picture up everywhere is kind of like, that's the ideal end goal of what he did. That's exactly what he wants from it. So like, I think more places should take the approach of, not necessarily what we're doing, because I think largely why we're doing it is due to like the delayed release of a podcast not being like a good avenue for on like events that are happening that are have some urgency to them,
stuff that needs rolling coverage. Yeah,
whereas I think a lot more places that are like immediacy orientated news, like television and print media, and like podcasts that come out like I know there's podcasts that come out daily, for instance. Not like it's taking the approach of the couple of French newspapers that have done this and saying like, we have a policy that we don't name anyone involved in any of this stuff unless you're a victim. Victims get named and that's fine, but like specific details of the event that aren't actually relevant to the end goal of it aren't really something that we think should get propagated necessarily.
Yeah, so we should probably add this to the website, like these kind of points of the things we're trying to do with our podcast.
That's an excellent idea, Kieran. Someone should do that.
So instead of the usual outro, I think we could just kind of leave it like this, where we say, you know, Happy New Year to all our listeners. Thank you for listening to us for this entire year. I'm not going to say the usual stuff, asking you to subscribe and review, because when you do that, that is great, and we really like it when you do that. But hopefully you've already done that. And, you know, enough about us. You're brilliant. Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Happy end 2017. I know it wasn't a great year for a lot of people, and 2018 for the win.
Yeah. Hot take prediction from Kieran: 2018 is also going to be terrible.
My number one prediction is more famous people that you like will die. It's a numbers game. There's too many people you're aware of now. Then they'll all die.
Jesus.
Positive note to end on.
Woo.